Welcome to Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Larry Ostola. In 1980, a determined and courageous young man set out on a remarkable run across Canada to raise funds for cancer research. His run was known as the Marathon of Hope, and his name was Terry Fox. Within months, Terry and his story had captivated the nation. Today, I have the pleasure and privilege of speaking with Bill Viggers, who accompanied Terry during his journey. He's the author of a new book entitled Terry and Me, the inside story of Terry Fox's Marathon of Hope, which was published by Sutherland House in 2023. Bill Viggers had a long and successful career in both print and broadcast media, as well as with major nonprofit organizations. He later turned to the world of public relations and became a well-known and highly respected publicist. In 1980, he found himself on the road with Terry Fox and his unforgettable Marathon of Hope. Bill, thanks for joining me today. It's really a pleasure to have the chance to speak to you.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be on this podcast with you.
Bill, why don't we start with some context? How exactly did you become involved with the Marathon of Hope?
January of 1980, I was always a volunteer with different organizations, and Cancer Society was one of them. And I was at a conference in Toronto, and they were going to hire somebody to be the head of public relations and fundraising for the province. I asked if I could apply for the job. They said, we've already done the interview, but if you want to get your resume, we'll give you an interview. In those days, I had to drive all the way back to Welland, Ontario, pick up my resume, drive back to Toronto. And I got an interview, and I was hired. And those first 3 months, my major job was, it was just before the April campaign, and we shipped daffodils from British Columbia to Ontario, thousands of them. And so my first responsibilities with them was setting up the April campaign. About 2 weeks into April of 1980, my boss, Harry Rollins, came, stood in my doorway, and he handed me a letter. It was two paragraphs long. And he said, there's a kid running across Canada with one leg. Do you want to go see what you can do for him? And that conversation changed the rest of my life. I followed Terry from afar. At that time, he was not getting any media at all. He was basically on page 7 of section 4 of the Toronto Star. Leslie Scrivener was writing about him. So that's how I kind of followed him. But then I got reports as he was going along on his journey. And it wasn't until mid-May when I first met him.
Where exactly did you meet Terry, Bill? And what were your initial impressions when you saw this remarkable young man?
Well, what I did find following him was that the biggest problem they were having the Cancer Society was Terry agreed to have a medical in every province. And subsequently, he wasn't showing up for them. The first one was in Newfoundland, and he was 150 miles into his journey and wasn't about to turn around and go back. The same thing happened in Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia. Mom and Dad flew down in New Brunswick to talk him into doing it. They couldn't do it. So what happened was is the Cancer Society sent me to New Brunswick to find out, who is this kid? Who is he for real? And talk him into doing his medicals. That was my journey. And my first time meeting him was in Edmondson, New Brunswick. And it was at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I knew the guys got up early to start. So I just slept in my car. It was at a roadside motel. The lights came on in the motel room. The guys walked out the door, and Doug Allward, Terry's driver and friend, and looked at me. And they were used to dealing with older gentlemen and older representatives of the Cancer Society. I was 33, wearing a T-shirt and jeans, rumpled. And the first thing out of Doug's mouth was, "You're the guy from the Cancer Society?" And that was my first introduction. We spent a few minutes talking I had brought some records and letters from home for Terry. And then we jumped in the van, and it was total darkness. There was hardly, it was the Trans-Canada Highway, a two-lane highway, and hardly any traffic on the road, basically just transports. And we drove about 5 or 6 miles down the road, and I'll talk in miles because that's what happened, or what we measured the run in those days. And we stopped in the middle of nowhere. And Doug, who was driving back and forth at the side of the road, I couldn't figure out what he was doing. But what he was doing, it was the night before, and that was their modus operandi. They had buried a plastic bag in the gravel by the side of the road with just a piece showing. And Terry insisted that he be able to open the van and step out on it so that no one could ever say that he didn't run every single step of the way. And as the journey continued, he would do the same. And if we were in an urban center, he'd go touch a telephone pole, a fire hydrant. Integrity was Terry. He got out. We drove off, left him in the darkness. And we drove a mile, exactly, because that's how Terry used to say, I can't run a marathon every day. I run 1 mile a day. I run a telephone post one at a time. And at the mile, he just ran past us. We pull out, we go ahead, we leave him in the darkness again, and there's not a sound out there except the roar of the trucks, and you can hear him coming for miles. And then they would drive past the van, and the whole van would shake. And I was looking in the rearview mirror, and there was the headlights coming from a truck, and he's running towards us. And I'm thinking to myself, how is he possibly doing this? I was in awe of him, of what he was doing in a physical way. At one point that morning, I said to Doug, I said, Doug, how do you watch him do this? And Doug said, I don't. And at first I didn't get it. And then I realized he couldn't watch his friend push himself that way. I saw that day very small clumps of people at the end of concession roads. It must have been passing by word of mouth, and they just said, stood there silently watching Terry run. They would hand us donations into the van. Terry never stopped. If a car honked, he'd give that famous wave of his, and he'd wave it at everybody. If somebody honked, he'd wave it at everybody. And then my best introduction to him was that evening when I listened to him speak in a small town, the town center. It was probably 300 or 400 people there. You could have heard a pin drop. And he talked about how he was running to try and find a cure for cancer, how he was motivated by his experience in the cancer ward back in Vancouver. When he had his leg amputated at 17, he was in the kids ward at Royal Columbian because they didn't want him in, because with that, it was older people. So the doctor chose to put him in that. Also, when he went through his cancer treatment, he was in the kids ward. So he was deeply, deeply affected by watching, you know, 5, 10-year-olds fighting cancer, some of them passing away while he was there in the hospital. And that's what drove him. There was no other motivation. There was no ego. He wasn't out there as a martyr. And people would say, why don't you stop and take a rest? And he would say, I can take a rest anytime I want. The people fighting cancer, kids, adults in the cancer wards, they can't take a rest. They got to keep fighting. So I'm not going to stop. There was no two sides to Terry. What you saw and what we learned about him 44 years ago, that was Terry Fox. There was no PR guy that made his speeches. It was his run. I could suggest things to him, but he was very strong-headed.
Bill, one of the things you touched on that really struck me when I read your book was, I mean, I knew obviously that there were huge challenges running and so on, but you mention in the book that an elite marathoner might train somewhere from 100 to 140 miles a week, and Terry was doing almost 200, which is just absolutely incredible. And I mean, I really think that speaks to the type of drive and determination that you were just referring to in your answer. And that must have been, I mean, you mentioned it was crystal clear right from the beginning.
Yes, and a lot of people don't realize that he trained. He didn't get up one day and just say, okay, I'm going to start now. He ran almost 5,000 miles over 3 years training before he actually started his run. When we met professional athletes, that always came up in the conversations with them. To a man, they would say something like, listen, we're professional athletes. We train and train and train. But we're in the dressing room talking about you, and we cannot comprehend how you're possibly being able to do this. And on the 143 days that he was on the road, he took off one day in Montreal, which is because I made him do it so that we would arrive in Ottawa on the right time. I thought it would rest him. It did not rest him. It threw off his pattern. And then a couple of times up in northern Ontario, actually really only once when we thought he had broken his ankle, he was off for a day and a half. But I have no, and nor do I think anybody has any explanation about how he did it.
That's just absolutely incredible, Bill. And I mean, I got the impression reading the book that so many people were affected seeing Terry. I mean, there's so many poignant moments in the book. You mentioned at one point that early one morning, once Terry had an escort from the Ontario Provincial Police, there was a provincial police officer who showed up early in the morning. He didn't appear to be too happy about getting this assignment at like 4 or 5 a.m., probably thinking to himself, what the heck's going on? And you went to see him. Tell us about his reaction. How did he react to seeing Terry for the first time?
Well, I found out after the run, matter of fact, when I was doing research for the book, that officers normally who got assigned to it were rookies, or this was initially because after everybody wanted to escort him. But at the beginning, it was either retired guys are about to retire. And I just saw this guy. I got the feel he was not happy to be there. And at the end of 2 miles, where Terry took his first rest stop, I walked back to the car and there were tears running down his face. And he just looked at me, and he had a difficult time talking, and he said, I can't figure out how he's doing this. I can't believe he's able to do this. And I just shrugged my shoulders and said, And at the next 5 minutes, we're driving down the road, and he now has his – oh, first off, I'm sorry – at the next stop, he says, look, people are trying to hand me money. I can't take the money. And I said, well, there's nothing I can do. You know, I go shrug my shoulders. And about 3 or 4 miles down the road, next thing I noticed, he's driving with his hand arm out the window with his officer's cap, collecting money from people who are driving by in the opposite direction. That's how Terry affected people.
Bill, you point out that in the book that the Canadian Cancer Society had never really dealt with anyone like Terry Fox before. What was the impact that you feel that he had on the society and on fundraising? Because there was a change, wasn't there?
There was. Terry was a disruptor in what we call an organization that's not how we run things. And initially, the Cancer Society wasn't really behind him. Even when I went down to meet him in New Brunswick, they were still not 100%, and I'm talking about the Ontario division. Are we in or are we out? The national office had agreed to, because it was kind of talked into by their chairman, by the name of Ron Calhoun, who actually coined the phrase Marathon of Hope in consultation with Terry. So at the beginning, there was a lot of pushback. And Ontario almost didn't get involved. And there was this meeting in Toronto with representatives from all across province. And it came down to a vote. And the two biggest divisions, Toronto and Hamilton at the time, didn't want to become involved. There were 7 divisions. They were outvoted. And I was on the road with them and joined them in Drummondville. As the run proceeded, and again, Terry, and I, this is a little convoluted answer to your question, because I have to explain that Terry did not want, nor did the family ever want anybody to usurp it commercially. So there was efforts during the run that some people within the society we're going to get sponsors for him, which he immediately turned down. And they had no idea, nobody had an idea of what impact he was going to have. And that first run, which, by the way, the first one was in 1981, September of 1981. And the impact, first with the telethon when he got sick, and he had raised about $1.5 million to that point. In one night, it went up to $10 million. By the time he passed away in June of 81, it had reached $24 million of $1 for every Canadian, which was the population of Canada at the time. That was his goal. And the Cancer Society could not comprehend the amount of money that was being raised in his name. And that first run in September of 1981, every city in every province, every little hamlet, the military and bases around the world were having in that very first Terry Fox run. And I think it changed fundraising, not just for the Cancer Society, but for other organizations, that community involvement, not just knocking on doors, which was the way the Cancer Society raised money for years. That was their sole source of funding. And now, today, there are so many good organizations who are following that format of raising funds.
So, Bill, you're on the road with the run with Terry. Public awareness is growing. And there were greater and greater demands placed on Terry, both to speak and appear at events along the route. You've mentioned the public reaction to Terry and how people reacted to actually seeing him and how they reacted to the message that he was bringing, often in a very simple way. But how difficult was it for you to manage these competing demands that were placed on him and a desire to have him appear?
There was no, this wasn't a plan. There was not a bunch of guys or people planning, okay, this is the route, this is what we're going to take. Terry had laid out a route. As a matter of fact, in New Brunswick, he was going to run as far as London, Ontario. And he pointed out to Ottawa, or rather to Windsor and Niagara Falls. And he said, I want to run there. And I said, well, when do you want to get home? You're going to add 10 days to your run. Because he wasn't used to the scope of the size of a map, looking at a BC map and Ontario map. The scale is completely different. What happened was, and it really came to, and it had a serious effect in our relationship. Some people, and I don't mention anybody by name in the book because they're not here to tell their side of the story, and I didn't want to embarrass them, but they wouldn't follow what Terry wanted to do. Terry's running a marathon a day, and then he has to go and make a speech. He made a speech every day. If it was convenient, once in a while he would too. But by the time we're in Southern Ontario, and after we've left Toronto, the pull on him to go to this event or that event, and 2 days out of Toronto, we're blindsided by two events that are 20 minutes apart. So he's got to finish 26 miles, make a speech, then we have to drive 15 minutes, make another speech, then drive the 15 minutes back and have dinner, and then get him to bed. And the person who had organized this was an employee of the Cancer Society, and we got into a set to that this wasn't the way it's supposed to be. Then he runs to London, he comes back up to around Georgetown, and the same thing happens, and it's the same guy who's come back into the picture. And this time, the two sites are half an hour apart. Finish a marathon, get in a van, drive a half hour back. So now he's getting to bed at 7:30, 8 o'clock. And when I had to break the news to Terry that there were two events, he got angry. I found out it was going to happen early in the morning, but I didn't tell him until lunchtime because I didn't want him to lose concentration. And what I would normally do is he'd go to a motel room or climb into a van or trying to get a nap, and I'd go and get him some lunch. This particular day, I'd got him a clubhouse sandwich and a French fry. I go into the motel room. I sit down. I tell him what's up. He said, I'm not going to go. And I said, well, they've told me they've sent somebody up from downtown, and I'm going to be taken off the run, and I'm probably going to be fired if you don't do it. And all I could do was sit there and, like, I was feeling mortified that I was having to say these words to Terry to force him to do this. And at one point, that aluminum foil container of French fries and clubhouse sandwiches flies just past my head. He could have got me if he wanted me. And all I could do was pick him up and look at him and say, I'm sorry. And I walked out, and after his rest, he came out, got in the truck. He drove. He never drove, him and Doug. And he laid rubber literally out of the parking lot back to the spot where he was starting. He went to the first reception, then drove all the way up, and it was up to Aurora, to the second reception. And we didn't speak for 2 or 3 days. And I thought that was the end of our relationship. And I actually went away, backed out. We were on the outskirts of Toronto. And I went back to my apartment, and I thought, no, I'm not, you know, we're going to work this out somehow. That was on a Friday. Sunday morning, I get a call from Doug. Doug says, you've got to come back right away. He's not speaking to anybody. He's in a horrible mood. You got to come back. And so I drove up, and by this time they're in Barrie. I figured out he told me where they had rested the night before. I went directly there. It was the Holiday Inn. I sat in the hallway outside his hotel room and waited for him to get up from his nap. And he came out, and we looked at each other, and I apologized to him profusely. I promised him, and he said, that's when he said, Bill, I've lost control of the run. I don't think it's my run anymore. People are making decisions for me, and they're not asking me. And I said, Terry, it will never, ever happen again. I give you my word. And then he looked at me, and he said, Bill, I just want to go home. I want to go home the fastest and shortest way possible. And then we hugged, and then we both started crying. And and then we stepped back, and I said, okay, listen, we can't let anybody see us crying, you know, because macho guys. I said, you go that door, I'll go that door. And it never happened again. I turned at that point, I made a conscious decision that I was working for Terry. I wasn't working for the Cancer Society anymore, and I didn't care what they were going to say.
Well, Bill, that's an amazingly powerful story, and it relates to one of the other questions that I wanted to touch on. It's another incident that you highlight in the book. There was an occasion when Terry was running, and a motorist began yelling out, "They're using you! They're using you!" You suggest in the book that it was out of concern that maybe Terry was being pushed too hard and pushed beyond his limits. But what was his reaction, and what happened next?
Terry never stopped for anything, ever. You know, he at the rest stops, he would talk to people. But I can probably count on one hand the times he stopped. For instance, when somebody might be leaving and he would stop. But on this particular occasion, I can remember it like it happened yesterday. It was at the confluence of Hamilton and Burlington. We had a major intersection. We're making a right-hand turn. Needless to say, there's complete traffic chaos, and there's a woman in a late model car with her window open, and she is screaming, "Stop it! Stop it! They're using you! They're using you! They're using you!" And this had come up, you know, in some reports that the Cancer Society was using Terry, and Terry stopped, and he was a very, very polite man, a very gentle man, but he walked over to this and in a very firm voice, he looked down and he said, "They're not using me enough." And then he turned around and started running away. And over the years, I thought to myself, you know, at first I was, you know, that lady upset his run and stuff like that. But in retrospect, she was probably somebody's mother. She was probably, her feelings were real. One could get that if they didn't know what was going on. So I, over the years, I've feelings about that whole incident have been very, very tempered by me in my thinking about where she was coming from at the time. But his response was, they're not using me enough, as in, I want to raise money. I want to raise money.
Well, Bill, there's another dimension to the marathon and to Terry's run that I wanted to raise. And it goes beyond the fundraising that we've just been talking about. Terry was also an advocate for amputees and by extension for the disabled at a time when that really wasn't common. How did that manifest itself? How did he do that when he was speaking to groups or when he was running in public?
I think right off the bat, I can say if back in 1980, it was extremely rare that you would ever see anyone with an amputated leg walking around in short shorts. He made it normal. There's a story in the book about a young girl who was a high school student who was in Oakville watching him, and she talked about how she was moved, about how he was doing it, and completely fascinated at looking at that artificial leg. She'd never seen one before. And that manifested it in many ways. That the country Cuba, has a Terry Fox run every year. And at one point, there was 3 million people participated. And my wife was down there one time, and she asked some people why Terry Fox had made such an influence on them and on the country. And they said, before that, cancer was a word that you didn't speak. It was like the Black Plague in that country. And nobody had ever seen anybody with an artificial leg. And Terry just acted, it was like it was normal. It was not uncommon for him to use this joke. You know, the first time he did it was, my kids travel with us, by the way, who were 8 and 9 at the time. First time they meet Terry, I say to Terry, hey, show the kids how your leg works. And he takes his real leg and moves it back and forth and goes, just like yours. And he used that many times. And, you know, we'd be in a restaurant and somebody would go, there's Terry Fox. And he'd look around and go, where? And then the rest of us at the table had this routine. We'd go, I'd stand up. Nope, not me. And their oldest brother would step. Nope, not me. And then Terry was, I guess that's me. So he was very open about the amputation. And it was just normal. I can remember up in Bruce Mines one day, the spring on the leg had broken, and we're having breakfast, and I'm sitting at the table, and I've got the leg up on the table, and I'm trying to fix the spring with a butter knife, get it back in there. And I realized everybody in the restaurant is watching this guy with that, you know, I got this artificial leg in the table. And to us, it was just normal. And I think he changed people's perception dramatically.
Oh, and that clearly was another key dimension to the Marathon of Hope that you know, I don't think has gotten the profile that that the fundraising has gotten. So that was a really interesting aspect of the book. But Bill, I'd like to wrap up by asking you one final question. So you're our witness to yesterday. After all of these years, after all the time you've had to reflect on Terry and his legacy and so on, is there a moment or memory in particular from the summer of 1980 that you'd be willing to share with us?
Terry's lived with me every day since then. It changed my life. Every day was an adventure. It was fun. If you see the book or if you get the book, the picture on the front is of him smiling, a big smile. That's how I remember Terry Fox. People think of Terry, and justly so, with that look of pain and determination on his face when he's running. But I remember him as a funny. He had a wonderful sense of humor. At ease, he loved kids. But I think the most... And it was the most dramatic, and it was also the most saddest moment for me. But it's also a moment that has driven me. On my last visit to see him, when he was in the hospital, I was at home, and we had been out, and we'd even gone to a movie and stuff like that. But he had to go back in for treatment. And we went back to the hospital, and my kids were with us, too, for that visit. And it was early October of 1980. And I kind of thought, you know, I don't know if I'm ever going to see him again. And the kids said goodbye to him. Terry was in his bed, and I hugged him. And I sent the kids downstairs. I said, I'll be down in a minute. And the hospital, and I hugged him in the bed, and I said, I love you. And I got to the door, and I turned around and hugged him again, and I said, I'm going to make you live forever. And that's what I've tried to do. And I've done my very, very best because, you know, I know Terry is such a man in Canadian history that whatever the story was going to be told had to be true, which is why there's so many secondary characters tell their story so we get their viewpoints. But the reason I wrote the book, eventually talked into it by my wife and people close to me, was to keep his legacy, alive. And I hope the book does it. I credit the education system in Canada and the annual runs, but he's still with us. He's still with me every day.
Well, Bill, I think you've rendered not only Terry, but all of us an enormous service with the publication of the book. And it really makes for some very, very moving reading. And so with that, I really want to thank you for taking the time and for joining me today.
It is an honor, Larry. Thank you very much.
My guest today was Bill Viggers. His book, Terry and Me, The Inside Story of Terry Fox's Marathon of Hope, was published by Sutherland House in 2023. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca. The best way you can support this podcast is by becoming a subscribing member of the Champlain Society. If you like what you've heard, let your friends know by forwarding this podcast through the social media of your choice. You can also send us an email at info@champlainsociety.ca. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We want to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Larry Ostola. This interview was recorded on March the 19th, 2024. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt and supported by the University of Toronto Press Journal team, who also support the Champlain Society.